Chapter 23. Waiters sporting red, white, and blue bow ties spread watercress sandwiches and iced wine in the dignitaries' pavilion. Bartenders, who had been issued similarly patriotic garters for their sleeves, rolled kegs of beer and carts of hard-boiled eggs into the shipworkers' tents on the riverbank. A warm breeze drifted through the enormous shed that covered the shipway. Sunlight filtered down from glass panels in the roof, and it appeared that half the population of Camden, New Jersey, had turned out to celebrate launching the battleship Michigan, whose 16,000 tons were balanced at the high end of a track of greased rails that slanted into the river. The shed still resounded with steel banging on wood, but the pace of the hammering had slowed. The wedges had lifted the battleship off nearly all her building blocks. But for a last few under her keel and bilges, she rested on the cradle she would ride down the ways. The ceremonial launching surrounding the ship's steel bow was draped with red, white, and blue bunting. A champagne bottle, wrapped in crocheted mesh to keep glass from flying and beribboned in the colors of the flag, waited in a bowl of roses. The battleship's sponsor, the pretty, dark-haired girl who would christen her, stood by in a striped flannel walking dress and a wide-brimmed Merry Widow hat heaped with silk peonies. She was ignoring the fevered instructions of an assistant secretary of the Navy, her father, who was warning her not to hold back at the crucial moment, but to whack her with all you've got the instant the ship starts to move or it'll be too late. Her gaze was fixed on a tall, golden-haired detective in a white suit, whose restless eyes were looking everywhere but at her. Isaac Bell had not slept in a bed since he arrived in Camden 2 days ago. He had originally intended to come down with Marion the night before the ceremony and dine in Philadelphia, but that was before the Philadelphia office had sent the urgent wire to New York. Disquieting rumors had begun to drift in concerning a mysterious German bent on disrupting the launch. Detectives assigned to the German immigrant community heard of a recent arrival who claimed to be from Bremen but spoke with a Rostock accent. He kept asking about finding work at New York ship, but had never applied to the company. Several hands had unaccountably lost the gate badges that identified them as employees. This morning at dawn, Angelo Del Rossi, the frock-coated proprietor of the King Street dance hall where Alistair MacDonald had been murdered, sought Bell out. He reported that a woman had come to him, distraught and frightened. A German who met the description of the man from Rostock, tall and fair, with troubled eyes, had confessed to the woman, who in turn had confessed to Del Rossi. "She's a part-time working girl, Isaac, if you know what I mean." "I've heard of such arrangements," Bell assured him. "What exactly did she say?" "This German she was with suddenly blurted out something to the effect that the innocent should not die. She asked what he meant. They had been drinking. He fell silent, then blurted some more, as drinkers will, saying that the cause was just but the methods wrong. Again she asked what he meant, and he broke down and began to weep and said, and this she claimed to quote exactly, 'The dreadnought will fall, but men will die.'" "Do you believe her?" "She had nothing to gain coming to me except a clear conscience. She knows men who work in the yard. She doesn't want them to be hurt. She was brave enough to confide in me." "I must speak with her," said Bell. "She won't talk to you. She doesn't see any difference between private detectives and cops, and she doesn't like cops." Bell pulled a gold piece from inside his belt and handed it to the saloon keeper. "No cop ever paid her $20 to talk. Give this to her. Tell her I admire her bravery and that I will do nothing to endanger her." He turned his gaze sharply on Del Rossi. "You do believe me, Angela, do you not?"
"Why do you think I came to you?" said Del Rossi. "I'll see what I can do."
"Is it enough money?"
"More than she clears in a week."
Bell tossed him more gold. "Here's another week. This is vitally important, Angelo. Thank you." Her name was Rose. She had offered no last name when Del Rossi arranged for them to meet in the back of his dance hall, and Bell asked for none. Bold and self-possessed, she repeated everything she had told Del Rossi. Belle kept her talking, probing gently, and she finally added that the German's parting words as he staggered from the private booth they had rented in a waterfront bar were, "It will be done." "Would you recognize him if you saw him again?"
"I should think so."
"How would you like to become a temporary employee of the Van Dorn Detective Agency?" Now she was cruising the shipyard in a summery white dress and a flowered hat, pretending to be the kid sister of two burly Van Dorn operatives disguised as celebrating steam fitters. A dozen more detectives were prowling the shipyard, checking and rechecking the identities of all who were working near the Michigan, particularly the carpenters driving the wedges directly under the hull. These men were required to carry special red passes issued by Van Dorn instead of New York ship, in case spies had infiltrated the offices of the shipbuilding firm. The runners who reported to Belle on the platform were chosen for their youthful appearance. Belle had ordered them to be attired like innocuous college boys, in boaters, summer suits, rounded collars, and neckties, so as not to unnecessarily frighten the throng that had come out to greet the new ship. He had argued strongly for a postponement, but there was no question of calling the ceremony off. Too much was riding on the launch, Captain Falconer had explained, and every party involved would protest. New York ship was proud to put Michigan in the water just ahead of Cramp's shipyard, South Carolina, which was only weeks behind. The Navy wanted the hull immediately afloat to finish fitting her out, and no one in his cabinet dared inform President Roosevelt of any delay. The ceremony was scheduled to start exactly at 11. Captain Falconer had warned Belle that they would launch on time. In less than an hour, the dreadnought would either slide uneventfully down the ways, or the German saboteur would attack, wreaking a terrible toll on the innocent. A marine brass band started playing a Sousa medley, and the launching stand got crowded with hundreds of special guests invited to stand close enough to actually see the champagne bottle crack on the bow. Belle spotted the Secretary of the Interior, three senators, the governor of Michigan, and several members of President Roosevelt's vigorous tennis cabinet. The top bosses of New York ship trooped up the steps in close company with Admiral Capps, the chief naval constructor. Capps seemed less interested in talking to shipbuilders than to Lady Fiona Abington Westlake, the wife of the British naval attaché, a beautiful woman with a shiny mane of chestnut hair. Isaac Belle observed her discreetly. The Van Dorn researchers assigned to the Hull 44 spy case had reported that Lady Fiona spent beyond her husband's means. Worse, she was paying blackmail to a Frenchman named Raymond Colbert. No one knew what Colbert had on her, or whether it involved her husband's purloining of French naval secrets. The German Emperor, Kaiser Wilhelm II, was represented by a saber-scarred military attaché, Lieutenant Julian von Strohm, recently returned from German East Africa, who was married to an American friend of Dorothy Langner. Suddenly, Dorothy herself parted the crowd in her dark mourning clothes. The bright-eyed, red-headed girl he had noticed at the Willard Hotel was at her elbow. Catherine D., research had reported, was the daughter of an Irish immigrant who had moved back to Ireland after making his fortune building Catholic schools in Baltimore. Orphaned soon after, Catherine had been convent-educated in Switzerland. The handsome Ted Whitmark trailed behind them, shaking hands and slapping backs and declaring in a voice that carried to the glass roof, "Michigan is going to be one of Uncle Sam's best fighting units." While Whitmark occasionally played the fool in his private life, gambling and drinking, at least before he met Dorothy, research had made it clear that he was extremely adept at the business of snagging government contracts. Typical of the incestuous relationships in the crowd of industrialists, politicians, and diplomats that swirled around the new Navy, he and Dorothy Langner had met at a clambake hosted by Captain Falconer. As Grady Forer of Van Dorn Research had remarked cynically, the easy part was discovering who's in bed with whom. The hard part is calculating why, seeing as how why can run the gamut from profit to promotion to espionage to just plain raising hell. Belle saw a small smile part Dorothy's lips. He glanced in the direction she was looking and saw the naval architect Farley Kent nod back. Then Kent threw an arm around his guest, Lieutenant Yurkovich, the Tsar's dreadnought architect, and plunged into the crowd as if to get out of the path of Ted and Dorothy. Oblivious, Ted seized an elderly admiral's hand and bellowed, "Great day for the Navy, sir! Great day for the Navy!" Dorothy's eyes wheeled Bell's way and locked with his. Bell returned her gaze appraisingly. He had not seen her since the day he had called on her in Washington, though he had, at Van Dorn's urging, reported to her by long-distance telephone that there was strong reason to hope that her father's name would soon be cleared. She had thanked him warmly and said that she hoped she would see him in Camden at the luncheon that would follow the launching. It occurred to Bell that neither Ted Whitmark nor Farley Kent would be pleased by the look she was giving him now. A warm breath whispered in his ear. "That's quite a smile for a lady dressed in mourning black." Marion Morgan glided behind him and made a beeline for Captain Falconer. He looked heroically splendid in his full-dress white uniform, she thought, or splendidly heroic, his handsome head erect in a high-standing collar, medals arrayed across his broad chest, sword at his trim waist. "Good morning, Miss Morgan," Lowell Falconer greeted Marion Morgan heartily. "Are you enjoying yourself?" She and Isaac had dined aboard Falconer's yacht last night. When Bell promised him that Arthur Langner would be completely vindicated of accepting bribes, her pride in her fiancé had spoken legions for her love. Still, Falconer admitted ruefully, he had not been disappointed when Bell had to excuse himself early to oversee another inspection of the ways beneath the ship. After the detective left, their conversation had flowed seamlessly from dreadnought design to moving pictures to naval warfare to the paintings of Henry Roitendahl to Washington politics and Falconer's career. He realized in retrospect that he had told her more about himself than he had intended to. The hero of Santiago knew himself well enough to acknowledge that he had fallen half in love with her. But he was completely unaware that the beautiful Miss Morgan was using him for cover as she tracked the head-bowing, hat-tipping passage through the crowd of an elegantly dressed Japanese. "Why," she asked Falconer, filling time, "is the shipbuilder called New York Ship when it's in Camden, New Jersey?" "That confuses everyone," Falconer explained with his warmest smile and a devilish glint in his eye. "Originally, Mr. Morse intended to build his yard on Staten Island, but Camden offered better rail facilities and access to Philadelphia's experienced shipyard workers. Why are you smiling that way, Miss Morgan?" She said, "The way you're looking at me, it's a good thing that Isaac is nearby and armed." "Well, he ought to be," Falconer retorted gruffly. "Anyway, Camden, New Jersey, has the most modern shipyard in the world. When it comes to building dreadnoughts, it is second only to our most important facility at the Brooklyn Navy Yard."
"And why is that, Captain?"
Her quarry was drawing near. "They embrace a thoroughly modern system. Major parts are prefabricated. Overhead cranes move them around the yard as easily as you'd assemble the ingredients to bake a cake. These sheds cover the ways so bad weather doesn't delay production."
"They remind me of the glass studios we use to film indoors, though ours are much smaller."
"Fittings that used to be mounted after launch are applied in the comfort of those covered ways. She'll be launched with her guns already in place."
"Fascinating."
The man she was watching had stopped to peer through a break in the scaffolding that revealed the ship's long armor belt.
"Captain Falconer, how many men will crew the Michigan?"
50 officers, 850 enlisted." She uttered a thought so grim that it shadowed her face.
"That is a terrible number of sailors in one small space if the worst happens and the ship sinks."
"Modern warships are armored coffins," Falconer answered far more bluntly than he would with a civilian, but their conversations last night had established an easy trust between them and left him in no doubt of her superior intelligence. "I saw Russians drowned by the thousands fighting the Japs in the Tsushima Strait. Battleships went down in minutes.
All but the spotters in the fighting tops and a few men on the bridge were trapped below decks.
Can I assume that our goal is to build warships that will sink slowly and give men time to get off?
The goal for battleships is to keep fighting. That means protecting men, machinery, and guns within a citadel of armor while keeping the ship afloat. The sailors who win stay alive.
So today is a happy day, launching such a modern ship.
Captain Falconer glowered at Marion under his heavy eyebrows. Between you and me, miss, thanks to Congress limiting her to 16,000 tons, Michigan has 8 feet less freeboard aft than the old Connecticut. She'll be wetter than a whale, and if she ever makes 18 knots in heavy seas, I'll eat my hat.
Obsolete before she is even launched.
Doomed to escort slow convoys. But if she ever tangles with a real dreadnought, it better be in calm waters.
Hell, he snorted.
We should anchor her in San Francisco Bay to greet the Japanese. A petite girl wearing a very expensive hat secured to her red hair with Taft for President Possum Billy hatpins stepped up.
Excuse me, Captain Falconer. I'm sure you don't remember me, but I had a wonderful time at a picnic on your yacht.
Falconer seized the hand that she had offered tentatively.
I remember you indeed, Miss D. He grinned.
Had the sun not shone on our clam bake, your smile would have made up for it. Marion, this young lady is Miss Catherine D. Catherine, say hello to my very good friend, Marion Morgan.
Catherine D.'s big blue eyes got bigger. Are you the moving picture director? She asked breathlessly.
Yes, I am.
I love Hot Time in the Old Town Tonight. I've seen it 4 times already.
Well, thank you very much.
Did you ever act in your movies?
Marion laughed.
Good Lord, no.
Why not? Captain Falconer interrupted. You're a good-looking woman.
Thank you, Captain, Marion said, casting a quick smile at Catherine D. But good looks don't necessarily show up on film. The camera has its own standards. It prefers certain kinds of features.
Like Catherine D.'s, she thought to herself. For some magical reason, the lens and the light tended to favor Catherine's type, with her petite figure, large head, and big eyes. Almost as if she could read her mind, Catherine said, "Oh, I wish I could see a movie being made."
Marion Morgan took a closer look at the girl. She seemed physically strong for one so petite. Strangely so. In fact, behind Catherine's breathless little girl manner, Marion sensed something slightly peculiar.
But didn't the camera also often transform peculiarities into characteristics that charmed the movie audience? She was tempted to confirm whether this girl indeed had qualities the camera would love, and an invitation was on the tip of her tongue. But there was something about her that made Marion uncomfortable. Beside her, Marion felt Lowell Falconer plumping up again, as he did whenever he saw a pretty girl. The woman approaching was the tall brunette who had been making eyes at Isaac earlier. Lowell stepped forward and extended his hand. Marion thought that Dorothy Langner was even more striking than the descriptions she had heard. She thought of a phrase uttered by her long-widowed father now that he was finally stepping out in late middle age. A looker.
"Dorothy, I am so glad you came," said Falconer. "Your father would be very proud to see you here."
"I'm proud to see his guns. Already mounted. This is a splendid shipyard. You remember Ted Whitmark?"
"Of course," said Falconer, shaking Whitmark's hand. "I imagine you'll be a busy fellow when the fleet replenishes at San Francisco. Dorothy, may I present Miss Marion Morgan?"
Marion was aware of being carefully measured as they traded hellos.
"And of course, you know Catherine," Falconer concluded the introductions. "We came up together on the train," said Whitmark. "I hired a private car."
Marion said, "Excuse me, Captain Falconer. I see a gentleman Isaac asked me to meet. Nice to meet you, Miss Langner, Mr. Whitmark, Miss D."
The pounding of the wedges suddenly stopped. The ship was fully on her cradle. Isaac Bell headed to the stairs for a final look below. Dorothy Langner intercepted him at the top of the stairs.
Mr. Bell, I was hoping to see you.
She extended her gloved hand and Bell took it politely. How are you, Miss Langner?
Much better since our conversation.
Vindicating my father won't bring him back, but it is a comfort and I am very grateful to you.
I am hoping that soon we will have definitive proof, but as I said, I personally have no doubt that your father was murdered, and we will bring his killer to justice.
Whom do you suspect?
No one I am prepared to discuss. Mr. Van Dorn will keep you appraised.
Isaac, may I call you Isaac?
All right, if you want.
There is something I told you once. I would like to make it clear.
If it's about Mr. Whitmark, Bell smiled. Be aware he's headed this way.
I will repeat, she said quietly. I am not rushing into anything. And he is leaving for San Francisco.
It struck Bell that a key difference between Marion and Dorothy was how they regarded men. Dorothy wondered whether she could add one to her list of conquests, whereas Marion Morgan had no doubt she could conquer and therefore was not inclined to bother. It showed in their smiles. Marion's smile was as engaging as an embrace. Dorothy's was a dare. But Belle could not ignore her desperate fragility, despite her bold manner. It was almost as if she were putting herself forth and asking to be saved from the loss of her father. He did not believe that Ted Whitmark was the man to do that.
Belle, isn't it? Whitmark called loudly as he bustled up. Isaac Belle. He saw tugboats gathering in the river to take charge of the hull when she hit the water.
Excuse me. I'm expected on the ways. Yamamoto Kenta had studied photographs of American warship launchings to choose his costume. He could not disguise that he was Japanese. But the less alien his clothes, the farther he could roam the shipyard and the closer he could approach the distinguished guests. Observing his fellow travelers on the train up from Washington, he was proud to see that he had dressed perfectly for the occasion in a pale blue-and-white seersucker suit and a pea-green four-in-hand necktie matched by the color of his straw boater's hatband. At the shipyard in Camden, he doffed the boater repeatedly in polite acknowledgment of ladies, important personages, and older gentlemen. The first person he had run into upon arriving at the remarkably up-to-date Camden shipyard was Captain Lowell Falconer, the hero of Santiago. They had spoken late last fall at the unveiling of a bronze tablet to commemorate Commodore Thomas Tingey, the first commandant of the Washington Navy Yard. Yamamoto had given Falconer the impression that he had retired from the Japanese Navy holding the rank of lieutenant before returning to his first love, Japanese art. Captain Falconer had given him a cursory tour of the arsenal, with the notable exception of the gun factory. This morning, when Yamamoto congratulated Falconer on the imminent launch of America's first dreadnought, Falconer had replied with a wry, "almost dreadnought," on the assumption, from one sea dog to another, that a former officer of the Japanese Navy would recognize her shortcomings. Yamamoto touched his brim once again, this time for a tall, strikingly blonde woman. Unlike the other American ladies who streamed past with chilly nods for that puny Asiatic, as he had heard one murmur to her daughter, she surprised him with a warm smile and the observation that the weather had turned lovely for the launching. "And for the blooming of the flowers," said the Japanese spy, who was actually comfortable with American women, having secretly romanced several high-ranking Washington wives, who had convinced themselves that a visiting curator of Asian art must be soulfully artistic as well as exotically Asiatic. At his flirtatious remark, he could expect her to either stalk off or move closer. He was deeply flattered when she chose the latter. Her eyes were a startling sea-coral green. Her manner was forthright. "Neither of us is dressed as a naval officer," she said. "What brings you here?" "It is my day off from where I am working at the Smithsonian Institution," Yamamoto replied.
He saw no bulge of a wedding ring under her cotton glove. Probably the daughter of an important official. A colleague in the art department gave me his ticket and a letter of introduction that makes me sound far more important than I am. And you? Art? Are you an artist? Merely a curator. A large collection was given to the institution. They asked me to catalog a small portion of it. A very small portion, he added with a self-deprecating smile.
Do you mean the Freer collection?
Yes, you know of it.
My father took me to Mr. Freer's home in Detroit when I was a little girl.
Yamamoto was not surprised that she had visited the fabulously wealthy manufacturer of railway cars. The social set that swirled around the American's new navy included the privileged, the well-connected, and the newly rich. This young lady appeared to be of the former. Certainly her ease of manner and sense of style set her off from the oft-shrill nouveau.
What, he asked her, do you recall from that visit?
Her engaging green eyes seemed to explode with light. What stays in my heart are the colors in Ashiyuki Utamoro's woodcuts.
The theatrical pieces.
Yes, the colors were so vivid yet so subtly united. They made his scrolls seem even more remarkable.
His scrolls?
The simple black on white of his calligraphy was so, what is the word? Clear, as if to imply that color was actually unessential.
But Ashiyuki Utamoro made no scrolls.
Her smile faded.
Do I misrecall?
She gave a little laugh, an uncomfortable sound that alerted Yamamoto Kenta that all was not well here.
I was only 10 years old, she said hurriedly.
But I'm certain I remember.
No, I guess I'm wrong. Aren't I the silly one?
I'm terribly embarrassed.
I must look like a complete ninny to you.
Not at all, Yamamoto replied smoothly while glancing about surreptitiously to see who on the crowded platform was watching them.
Nobody he could see.
His mind was racing. Had she tried to trick him into revealing gaps in his hastily acquired knowledge of art? Or had she made a genuine mistake? Thank the gods that he had known that Ashiyuki Utamoro had presided over a large print shop and had not been the monastic sort of artist who toiled alone with a few brushes, ink, and rice paper. She was looking about as if desperate for an excuse to break away.
I'm afraid I must go, she said. I'm meeting a friend.
Yamamoto tipped his boater, but she surprised him again. Instead of immediately fleeing, she extended her long, slender, cotton-gloved hand and said,
We've not been introduced. I enjoyed talking with you. I am Marion Morgan.
Yamamoto bowed, thoroughly confused by her openness. Perhaps he was paranoid. Yamamoto Kenta, he said, shaking her hand. At your service, Miss Morgan. If you ever visit the Smithsonian, please ask for me.
Oh, I will, she said, and strolled away.
The puzzled Japanese spy watched Marion Morgan sail sleek as a cruiser through a billowing sea of flowered hats. Her course converged with that of a woman in a scarlet hat heaped with silk roses. Their brims angled left and right, forming an arch under which they touched cheeks. Yamamoto felt his jaw go slack. He recognized the woman who greeted Marion Morgan as the mistress of a treacherous French Navy captain who would sell his own mother for a peek at the plans of a hydraulic gyro engine. He felt a strong urge to remove his boater and scratch his head. Was it coincidence that Marion Morgan knew Dominique Duval? Or was the beautiful American spying for the perfidious French? Before he could ponder further, he had to doff his boater to a beautiful lady dressed head to toe in black.
May I offer my condolences? He asked Dorothy Langner, whom he had met at the unveiling of the bronze tablet at the Washington Navy Yard shortly before he murdered her father.
A master carpenter in blue-striped overalls served as Isaac Bell's guide when he made his final inspection under the hull. They walked its length twice, up one side and down the other. The last of the wooden shores bracing the ship had been removed, as had the poppets,
the long timbers holding her bow and her stern. Where there had been a dense forest of lumber was a clear view alongside the cradle from front to back. All that remained leaning against the ship were temporary tumbler shores, heavy timbers designed to fall away as she began to slide down the flat rails, which were thickly greased with yellow tallow. Nearly every keel block supporting the vessel had been removed. The final blocks were assembled from four triangles bolted into single wooden cubes. Carpenters disassembled them by unscrewing the bolts that held them together. As the triangles fell apart, the battleship settled harder on the cradle. Swiftly, they unbolted the bilge blocks, the last holding her, and now Michigan's full weight came on the cradle with an audible sighing of minutely shifting plates and rivets. "All that's holding her now are the triggers," the carpenter told Bell. "Yank them and off she goes." "Do you see anything amiss?" the detective asked. The carpenter stuck his thumbs in his overalls and peered around with a sharp eye. Foremen were herding workmen off the ways and out of the shed. With the hammering of the wedges finally stopped, it was eerily quiet. Bell heard the tugs hooting signals on the river and the murmur of the expectant throng above him on the platform. "Everything looks right as rain, Mr. Bell. Are you sure?" "All they've got to do now is bust that bottle." "Who is that man with the wedge ram?" Bell pointed at a man who abruptly appeared carrying a long pole over his shoulder. "That is a mighty brave fellow getting paid extra to poke the trigger if it jams." "Do you know him?" "Bill Strong. My wife's brother's nephew by marriage." A steam whistle blew a long, sonorous blast. "We ought to get out of here, Mr. Bell. There'll be tons of junk falling off her when she moves. If it happens to brain us, folks will say she's an unlucky ship. Launched in blood." They retreated toward the stairs that led up to the platform. As they parted at the juncture where the carpenter would join his mates on the riverbank and Bell would continue up to the christening, the tall detective took one last look at the ways, the cradle, and the dull red hull. At the bottom of the ways, where the rails dipped into the water, massive iron chains were heaped in horseshoe loops. Attached to the ship by drag cables, the chains would help slow her as she slid into the water. "What is that man doing with the wheelbarrow?" "Bringing more tallow to grease the ways." "Do you know him?" "Can't say that I do. But here comes one of your men checking him now." Bell watched the Van Dorn intercept him. The man with the wheelbarrow showed the bright red pass required to work under the ship. Just as the detective stepped aside, motioning for the man to continue, someone whistled, and the detective ran in that direction. The man lifted the handles of his barrow and wheeled it toward the rails. "A regular patriot," said the carpenter.
"What do you mean?"
"Wearing that red, white, and blue bow tie. A regular Uncle Sam, he is. See you later, Mr. Bell. Stop by the workman's tent. I'll buy you a beer." He hurried off, chuckling. "I'm thinking of getting me one of those bow ties for Independence Day. The waiters was wearing them at the boss's tent." Bell lingered, studying the man pushing the wheelbarrow toward the back of the ship. A tall man, thin, pale, hair hidden under his cap. He was the only man on the ways except for Bill Strong, who crouched with his ram hundreds of feet away at the bow. Coincidence that he wore a waiter's bow tie? Did he get past the gates pretending to be a waiter until the ways were cleared and it was time to make his move unhindered? His pass had convinced the detective, though. Even at this distance, Bell had seen it was the proper color. He began hastily shoveling globs of tallow out of the barrow onto the flat rail. So hastily, Bell noticed, that it looked more like he was emptying the barrow rather than spreading the grease. Isaac Bell plunged down the stairs. He ran the length of the ship at a dead run, drawing his Browning. "Elevate!" he shouted. "Hands in the air!" The man whirled around. His eyes were big. He looked frightened. "Drop the shovel. Put your hands in the air." "What is wrong?" "I showed my red pass." His accent was German. "Drop the shovel!" He was gripping it so tightly that tendons stood like ropes on the backs of his hands. A hoarse cheer erupted overhead. The German looked up. The ship was trembling. Suddenly, it moved. Bell looked up too, sensing a rush from above. In the corner of his eye, he glimpsed a timber thick as railroad crosstie detach from the hull and tumble toward him. He leaped back. It crashed in the space in which he had been standing, knocking his broad-brimmed hat off his head and brushing his shoulder with the force of a runaway horse. Before Bell could recover his balance, the German swung the shovel with the gritted teeth determination of a long ball hitter, determined to turn a soft pitch into a home run.